First of all, we made it to Friday, so that's a good thing. More to the point, though, is this week the new normal, do you think? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 9th of February. Glad to have you with us, everybody. I think, honestly, we are just going to get right to it because, holy cow, what a week, right? Here to dissect the 5 days gone by are Kate Davidson from The Wall Street Journal, also Sheila Kolhatkar from The New Yorker magazine. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Sheila, let me ask you first. With the tax bill and its fiscal stimulus, right, all the deficit spending we're doing, the new budget bill with its debt, and the prospect of inflation from the wages report that came out on Friday, is this volatility, is this unease the new normal, do you think? Test my premise.
Well, personally, I take a little satisfaction when the market sort of reminds us mm-hmm. that it does not only have an up mode. Right. It can also go down. I think people tend to get a little complacent when it's just sort of shooting up all the time and everyone feels just happy and wealthy. And I think there are some signs that the investor class may be a little worried about the stewardship of the economy under the Trump administration. And although the administration has done very stimulating things like mm-hmm. these huge corporate tax cuts, there's concern among economists that they have not been fiscally responsible, and the market seems to be reacting to that.
Well, so, Kate, let's talk about that for a second, right? Because we have an economy basically at full employment. It is growing at 2.3-ish something percent. We are piling on money. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, this is a really important question, Kai, and I think it's one that economists and policymakers, say at the Fed, are really looking at carefully. And the honest answer is we just don't know. I mean, we haven't seen a big stimulus like this so late in an economic expansion. You know, normally we'd see it earlier when the economy is not doing so well. But as you pointed out, we're close to full employment. We're growing at sort of this low and steady pace that obviously Republicans have said they want to raise higher. But there's a lot of economists think that we're close to, the economy is operating at close to its full potential already. So boosting growth now through all of this stimulus could start to push up inflation. Wages will start to rise, prices will go up, and that's where things get risky, right? Yeah. You know, the Fed could respond to that, interest rates could go higher, that could tip us into a recession. So we don't really know what's going to happen.
Sheila, I want to be clear here. You know, when the White House has been asked the past couple of days, Secretary Mnuchin said it on Friday and Raj Shah said it yesterday in the briefing room, the economic fundamentals in this economy are strong. We ought to be clear about that.
I think everyone agrees the numbers look very good. The economy is in its ninth year of a recovery, and unemployment is just over 4%. That's all very positive. However, there are many economists who mm-hmm. feel that this is an opportunity to kind of get the house in order and to start to use some of that money mm-hmm. to pay down debt, for example, rather than borrowing more mm-hmm. When we don't necessarily need it. And then, of course, there's the question of what happens if there's another financial crisis, and no one knows if and when that will occur. But it doesn't leave the government a lot of room right. to maneuver to kind of boost the economy if things really start to slow down. So that is worrying to some.
Right. Well, so first of all, there is going to be another financial crisis, right? I mean, we don't know when, we don't know what it's going to be, but it's coming because they always do. Let me, Kate, just to Sheila's point on the debt and the amount of money we're piling on here. I want to play for you Senator Rand Paul on the floor of the Senate last night doing his delay of the budget vote that got us that 5-hour shutdown, whatever it was. Here he is talking to his colleagues last night on the Senate floor.
I want them to have to answer people at home who said, how come you were against President Obama's deficits? And then how come you're for Republican deficits? Isn't that the very definition of intellectual dishonesty?
Kate Davidson, discuss.
Well, I can tell you what fiscal hawks were saying in response to that clip, which is it's awfully rich for Rand Paul to be making that argument when he voted in support of this massive tax cut that is projected to add about $1 trillion to the deficit,
totally
even
true.
After accounting for the boost to economic growth. Now, if you step back and setting that aside for a moment, I mean, his overall point is, I think, perhaps that a lot of Republicans have reversed themselves on deficits. And I think that's basically right. A number of folks who have been committed for many years to fiscal restraint. You know, that is, people who are outside of government looking in are thinking, what is going on? You know, the Republican Party has talked for many, many years about spending restraint and balancing budgets, and now they're moving in this opposite direction. Mm-hmm. So I understand that that was what Rand Paul was getting at. But I think these same people would argue, look, you're adding to the deficit. Tax cuts add to the deficit, and you know, spending increases do. You know, one is not better or worse than the other. They both add to the deficit. So if you're supporting one or the other, you're still guilty.
Right. And votes matter. That's Kate Davidson of The Wall Street Journal and Sheila Kolhatkar at The New Yorker Magazine. Thanks, you two.
Thanks.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, I'm just going to say this. The Dow Industrials traded in a 1,000-point range this Friday, up, down, every which way. You want volatility? That there, folks. That is some volatility. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so let's talk about inflation here for a second. Both Sheila and Kate referred to it. It's gotten a lot of press this week here and elsewhere, mostly the prospect of it as an underlying driver of the craziness in stocks. But you know what? For big parts of this economy, inflation is already here, specifically for American businesses. The index is called the Producer Price Index, and it turns out companies are paying higher prices for raw materials and ingredients, everything from car makers to restaurant groups. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth went to find out if, when, and how those higher prices for businesses are going to mean higher prices for you and me.
The easiest way to understand producer price inflation is hamburgers. Say the price of corn or soybeans goes up, it costs more to feed the cow. So the rancher's costs go up, which makes the processor's costs go up, which makes the restaurant costs go up, and then your burger cost, well, hang on.
The concern is, who bears the brunt of those increased costs? Is it the producers who sell the goods, or is it the consumers who want to purchase the goods?
And it's not just corn and hamburgers, says Ryan Connolly of research firm Frontier Strategy Group. As growth strengthens around the world, that's increasing demand and prices for many basic materials of production.
More demand for steel, more demand for aluminum, more demand for component parts in cars that take precious metals like palladium or gold.
Connolly says most companies faced with rising costs want to turn their producer price inflation into consumer price inflation.
One of the biggest questions we get is, how can we increase our ability to pass through costs on to consumers?
And companies like 3M have told Wall Street they may raise prices, says Richard Moody, chief economist of Regions Bank. Thing is,
corporate profit margins are very high relative to historic norms.
In other words, businesses have plenty of room to swallow high costs without passing them on right now. But, says Moody,
if firms can raise prices, they will raise prices.
Case in point, McDonald's is rolling out a new dollar menu, but at the end of last year, prices were up 3% from the year before. In New York, I'm Ryan Kyloth for Marketplace.
Let me be really clear as I set up this next story. What's been happening in the markets this week is not, repeat, not the same thing that happened as the financial crisis was driving stocks down 9 or 10 years ago. The fundamentals are good right now. We were due for a correction anyway, and there is no reason to get all jittery and do something crazy with your retirement savings, people. But that said, this economy and the people in it have changed in the past 10 years, and that is affecting some of the calculations people are making. From our desk at WESA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Marketplace's Erica Barris has more.
I met Andrew Andoga in downtown Pittsburgh a few weeks ago when I was asking people how they felt about the economy. Andoga, a commercial lighting salesman, told me he thought things were so good, maybe he should cash out.
My financial advisor, I called him. He said, no, it's not over with yet.
I called Andoga back to see how he was feeling about his retirement now.
I feel fairly confident because I'm still about 20 points up from where I was about 2 years ago.
But that doesn't mean he isn't thinking about his retirement. He's 60 years old.
You get a larger level of concern about where you are and where your mindset is about when you could actually retire.
10 years ago, at the beginning of the financial crisis, Andoga had friends who were about to retire, then couldn't. There are about 40 million Americans close to retirement age now, says Rachel Franklin of Brown University. She says, surprisingly, millennials seem more worried because they grew up during the Great Recession.
This is probably, psychologically speaking, potentially a bigger hit for them, even though they're going to have a much longer time frame in which to recoup their losses.
Julia Golden Battle is 34. And when she looked at her retirement this week, she almost did panic. But Golden Battle has a good job and says,
I have some time to recover, and I recognize that some folks who are close to retirement, dips like this make them more nervous.
As for Andrew Andoga, he's at least 6 years from retirement. But he says he has a cash-out number if markets continue to dive. In Pittsburgh, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Up and down on Wall Street today, as I said. On the downside, shares of FedEx and UPS, after the Wall Street Journal reported that Amazon is closer to actually rolling out a shipping service of its own. It's being piloted here in Los Angeles, delivering stuff sold by third-party vendors on Amazon's site. It's an interesting and possibly eventually significant entry in the getting stuff into consumers' hands business. But as Marketplace's Aaron Trank reports, Amazon is still a long ways from replacing its present delivery partners.
Amazon's been ramping up its own delivery operations for years, but the e-commerce giant is still heavily reliant on the vast networks of UPS and FedEx to get stuff to your house. Analyst Roger Kay at Endpoint Technologies doesn't see that changing.
Amazon, in order to really compete directly, would have to field an enormous fleet of trucks and have all of these depots and warehouses, and there's quite a lot of investment there.
UPS plans to spend $7 billion this year upgrading its delivery network. Supply chain consultant Foster Finley at Alex Partners says Amazon does have one advantage, more real-time consumer data.
They basically have great insight into availability, shipment points, stock, more so than UPS and FedEx, who typically are limited to saying this is what happened last year.
Amazon packages account for about 7% of UPS's volume and less than 3% for FedEx. Growing e-commerce sales have been good for major carriers, but Michael Pachter at Wedbush Securities says Amazon isn't quite ready to compete in that space.
FedEx and UPS weren't invented one day. These guys have been in these businesses for decades, and they're survivors because they're really good at it.
Pachter says Amazon probably isn't trying to replace its partners, just squeeze better deals out of them.
And if FedEx and UPS say, okay, instead of making a 10% margin on your business, we'll make an 8% margin, Amazon wins.
A FedEx spokesman says the notion of Amazon being a real threat, quote, demonstrates a lack of basic understanding of the full scale of the global transportation industry. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Coming up.
These machines all right here are all working without a person working in them.
Good for the environment, not so good maybe for the people. First, though, let's do the numbers. So, up 330 points on the Dow Jones Industrial Average today, 1.3%, 24,190. The NASDAQ up 97 points, 1.4%, 6874. The S&P 500 up 38 points, about 1.5%, 26.19. Now, for the week that we just lived through, feels like we're a long way from where we started Monday, right? Dow and S&P dropped 5.2% apiece. NASDAQ dropped 5.1%. Amazon, as we said, thinking about shipping and delivery. Amazon down 0.8%. FedEx down 1.6%. UPS down 2.6%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus rose up to 2.85%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizal. The Olympics are officially open, as you will be able to see on tape delay tonight on NBC. The broadcaster says more than $900 million worth of advertising has been sold against the Games, and that's just in this country. The Olympics, of course, are maybe the best opportunity advertisers have to get themselves in front of a global audience. But I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that whatever corporate sponsorship or viral ad does come out of these Games, it is not going to be as big as this one was.
Who is the world's greatest athlete, Dan or Dave? Dan's mom. Dan. Dave's mom. Dave. Dan's coach. Dan. Dave's coach. Dave. Dan's dentist.
Dan. Dan O'Brien and Dave Johnson in an ad campaign for Reebok in front of the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona.
To be settled in Barcelona.
Except that $30 million of Reebok's dollars later, things went awry. Jody Avergan told the story in an episode of ESPN's 30 for 30 podcasts. Jody, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that this ad campaign by Reebok might have been the most famous Olympic ad campaign maybe ever. You?
I think that's probably right. We haven't done any 30 for 30s on other Olympic ad campaigns,
well,
so there you go.
You
know, and the real question is, what is it famous because it was considered, quote unquote, a bust, or was it just a huge play regardless and maybe would have been the most famous, you know, even if it hadn't turned out the way it turned out?
Well, so we'll get to the answer to that one, my answer to that one in a minute. But do me a favor, remind us who Dan and Dave were.
So Dan and Dave were two decathletes in the early 90s. They were at the top of decathlon. They were both Americans, basically number one, number two in the world. And going into the Barcelona Games in 1992, Reebok decided to go all in on these two athletes. And they launched a campaign, Dan versus Dave. It kicked off with four different ads running through the Super Bowl that really hyped, in this sort of very mysterious manner, this looming showdown between Dan and Dave.
Ought to say here that Reebok was nowhere in terms of certainly athletic footwear, but athletic wear writ large.
Yeah, there was this moment. Well, that's not one moment. I think you can write the kind of history of Reebok and Nike as basically every 10 years, Reebok convincing themselves that, you know what, we're going to finally win the sneaker wars and we're going to overtake Nike. This was one of those moments in the early 90s where they really thought that they were going to, you know, become dominant and really make this big play. And, you know, in retrospect, you go, really? Like, you were going to take out Nike with two decathletes? But they were only able to make these big splashy plays by picking relatively obscure athletes from a relatively obscure sport.
Right.
They weren't going to compete with Nike with NBA athletes or NFL athletes. Right. They needed to do something splashy in order to try and win this battle.
So they get to the Olympic trials in New Orleans in the summer of 92. They are probably the most famous athletes in American track and field, for sure, possibly the world. And it all comes down to this. And here's my answer to your question in the beginning. I think this ad campaign became what it was, and it became this thing of culture because one of them didn't make it, you know?
Yeah. Well, looking back, what everyone remembers is that every single one of these ads, starting in the Super Bowl, ends with Dan versus Dave to be settled in Barcelona. Well, you know, maybe this is too complicated to get into in a national ad campaign, but you have to qualify in order to get to Barcelona and have that showdown between Dan and Dave. And of course, famously, Dan O'Brien does not end up qualifying. He was the best decathlete at the time. I think Dave Johnson would admit that as well. And he just had basically his one off day in a kind of like 15-year stellar career on that day in New Orleans in that qualifying event for the Games. And all of a sudden, the Reebok executives are going, uh-oh, we made all these promises, and now one of our two guys is not going to be in Barcelona.
This makes me a terrible person, but maybe my favorite piece of tape in this entire podcast is the Nike guy sitting in the stands at the Olympic trials in New Orleans watching Dan O'Brien no-height the jump.
Yeah, we were actively hoping that something bad would happen. I don't know how else to put it. I'd like to lie and say, no, it didn't make a difference, but it made a difference, of course. The truth is, we were just happy. I mean, what are you going to say?
Yeah, I mean, that might be my favorite piece of tape as well. I mean, you know, what else would you expect a Nike exec to say? But funny enough, actually, both Dan O'Brien and Dave Johnson end up becoming Nike athletes later down the line in their career. And they actually got to know this exec pretty well, so he's pals with them. But at the moment, sure, there's a part of him that's like, yeah, great. Like, to watch your main rival just, like, go up in flames like that with this big ad campaign, I like that tape too.
Do you think that this kind of ad campaign could work today with Olympic athletes just because of, first of all, the saturation of the Olympics in culture today, but also because of how cynical we've become about marketing in sports?
It's a good question. I mean, I think we can look to this year, right? We just had a Super Bowl, and the ads that NBC was running were kind of, I would say, for the more typical group of sports. You had your figure skaters and you had your downhill skiers. They weren't plucking a curler and being like, we're going to turn this person into a star.
Right.
We don't maybe see as much of this kind of like, we can, through sheer force of, you know, money and marketing, turn a relatively obscure person into a huge star overnight. I think those days are probably over.
Huh. Jody Avergan is the producer and host of 30 for 30 podcast. The one we've been talking about is called The Trials of Dan and Dave. It's really good. Check it out. Jody, thanks a lot.
You got it. Thanks.
Here's an unfortunate economic truism. Technology, especially when used in industrial applications, can often be better for the environment than people doing the same jobs. But then when you use that technology, people lose their jobs. The specific case in point here is some of the last best blue-collar jobs in Southern California, longshoremen at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, some of the busiest ports in the world, by the way. From KPCC, Emily Guerin reports.
There are 22 massive docks at the Port of Long Beach where ships pull up to load and unload cargo. At all but one of those docks, people do all the work, operating cranes, driving forklifts, and securing containers onto rail cars. But at that last dock, robots do almost all of that. I took a tour with dock worker Gary Herrera.
I actually have to be on my absolute best behavior because I do not like what this place stands for.
Herrera is the vice president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 13. For decades, this union has fought to preserve jobs in the face of increasing mechanization at the ports. The Long Beach Container Terminal opened in April 2016, and it's the first one to be almost fully automated. Herrera points to a row of red, white, and blue cranes moving cargo containers.
These machines all right here are all working without a person working in them.
Those machines represent the loss of some really well-paid jobs. ILWU members make an average of $155,000 a year. But the union estimates two-thirds of those jobs here are gone due to automation. And the ones that remain are different. Mechanics fix the robots, and crane operators run 48 cranes at once from an air-conditioned room using a joystick. Herrera grimaces, and his hands are tight on the steering wheel.
It makes me sick to my stomach. It does.
But Adrian Martinez with the law firm Earth Justice has a different reaction.
It's exciting to see zero emissions equipment actually on the terminal.
See, here's the thing about these automated machines. They don't just eliminate jobs, they also eliminate pollution. They run on electricity, not diesel. That means compared to a traditional dock, the Long Beach Container Terminal has a third fewer carbon dioxide emissions and about 85% less diesel pollution. Martinez says these reductions are a big deal because residents in the port area have a disproportionately high cancer risk from breathing polluted air, according to local air regulators.
From a basic level, we're not going to solve the air pollution crisis in the Los Angeles region until we eliminate port and freight pollution.
Herrera with the Longshoremen's Union says he's aware that breathing diesel fumes is bad for the union workers. But he says being out of work is bad too.
We know the dangers of being a longshoreman. I know the risks.
The Port of Long Beach and its neighbor, the Port of Los Angeles, are the busiest in the country. And in November, the port set an ambitious goal of phasing out diesel and gasoline vehicles in favor of electric ones by 2035. The question is, will that lead to more automation? Back at the terminal, Herrera says he has his answer. He's watching one of the 72 self-driving, zero-emissions machines glide by.
They got rid of jobs. And so this is why we are skeptical at all when they want to say zero emissions.
So skeptical that the ILWU convinced the California legislature to make sure no public money can be used for automation at the ports. Union workers say they aren't against electric vehicles. They just want to be the ones driving them. In Long Beach, I'm Emily Guerin for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the end of a retailing era, really, and a lesson in what happens when a few bad apples ruin it for the rest of us, and you know who you are. L.L. Bean said today its famous lifetime guarantee is no more. Quote, increasingly, a small but growing number of customers has been interpreting our guarantee well beyond its original intent. End of quote. From now on, it seems returns and replacements are going to be limited to 1 year. Now, about that pair of old L.L. Bean boots I've got in my garage, what do I do with them? All right, we got to go. Look, only 2 days till Monday trading opens, huh? Dow Industrial's up 330 points this Friday, 1.3%. NASDAQ up 97 points, 1.4%. S&P 500 up 38, 1.5%. 5% or more losses across the board this week on the major indices. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Nancy Fargali is the executive producer of this program. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.